CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 96 with Dr. Ivan Gaborich, advancing the limits of corneal refractive surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And this time, I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Ivan Gaborich from Zagreb, Croatia. And we're going to talk about my amazing experience visiting his clinic and what's the future of laser vision correction going to be. Ivan, welcome to my podcast, buddy.
Thank you very much. I feel especially honored to be hosted by you. This is probably the only regularly scheduled ophthalmology podcast in the entire world. So I saw many great people here. I listened to almost all of them. And now me, a kid from Zagreb, Croatia, 35 years old, am here. It's an honor, man.
Oh, I love it. No, it's been a lot of fun. The podcast, I tell you, I learn a lot by doing it. And yeah, we've amazing. It's the number one podcast, top podcast in all of ophthalmology.
So I honestly believe you because look, you yourself are one of the most well-known, most prominent eye doctors on the planet. And most of your speakers are maybe not on your level, but they are quite well-known.
And oh my God, they're better than me.
Yeah, but look, honest to God, you had great people on, and every time you listen to them, and it's always learning something new. As a listener, there's always that little trick, and you kind of get to break down the barriers of, you know, when you're with someone in their clinic, and thank you for joining me in mine a few months ago, you're always trying to impress someone. You're trying to show off your best, but sometimes people only see the good side, and in these podcasts, they often talk about the problems they face, the hurdles. It's very easy when you see someone, like, look, I got a notice the other day that an instructional course I submitted for ASCRS was approved. Okay. It's going to be managing lenticular complications, which is a huge passion of mine, and sure. I'm thinking in my head, wow, I'm going to do the course. I'm going to teach something to someone, but for me to be able to show them something, I had to make a lot of mistakes. And oftentimes I have doctors come and visit and they see me do these cases and they look so fluid and so easy and they get bummed out saying, why is it so easy for him? It's not easy. You have to really break down and be honest. Each one of us made millions of mistakes.
Right. And I think that's the best way of learning is from complications. We've learned that the most fun is, okay, here's the problem. How'd you solve it? Yeah,
exactly.
For sure.
And the thing is, when you meet someone and you get to talk, it's kind of like a date, you know. In the first 10 minutes of a date, you're going to show off your car, your house, your your beach house and whatever, everything nice about you.
Yeah.
But you know what? That doesn't make you you.
Right.
The things that got you there, that's what makes you you. And that's what I think you managed to break down, and the people you have on, we kind of share it. And this is what I want to try that with you today.
Oh, we're going to have fun. Well, as you know, these podcasts, they're not scripted. It's just a simple conversation.
I know. Look, my way of scripting and starting this is I texted you, hey, can we push it back 30 minutes? Because in that chair, I still have people. And I just got the last one out a minute ago. And it's such an interesting case. It's a guy in his late 40s. He's a unilateral amblyope and hypermetropia of +2 in one eye, +4 in the other eye, plus presbyopia. And he wants laser vision correction. I'm like, look, man, I love laser vision correction, but it's not a panacea. It's not going to solve every problem on the planet.
Right.
You need a lens-based solution, brother.
Right. That's the neat thing in your clinic is that you've got this beautiful clinic in Zagreb, which you have the entirety of ophthalmology in there.
But look, it wasn't like that. When my dad started in 1998, he was 37. And Croatia just ended the war for independence. And it was a post-socialistic country. There was no private health care. And he wanted to kind of make it better. And he went out of his way, got some loans from some, you know, not the regular traditional financial institutions, if I may say so.
Okay.
And he went out and bought a laser to do PRK for myopia and hyperopia. It was the first laser of that kind in this part of the world. It was in 1998, but he couldn't afford a laser sight or a Summit or a Vizik. So he bought a machine from Taiwan from a guy who was the patent holder for laser sight, J.T. Lin. Oh, wow. And that laser, he saw it in Japan, and he invested a lot of money. No bank wanted to finance that because he went out to banks and said, listen, I want to buy a laser to get people rid of their glasses. And they're like, what? No. It's like today, it's a very common thing to go out and get a loan and buy a refractive laser. But he got the money, he got the laser, and then he started doing PRKs, then started to dabble with refractive lens exchange because he was a great cataract surgeon from his time in the National Health Service. And he built a core of our business around this patient-centric care. And for us, the patient, he always says that, and it's a very rough translation, so do excuse it. The patient is God for us. Right. We bow to the patient, not the other way around.
Put the patient first.
Yes. The patient is in the center of everything we do. And the patient and their needs have to be met with respect. It doesn't matter how crazy they might sound or if they have a problem, which you don't acknowledge.
Right.
You have to listen to them and you have to make sure they are feeling this. They know that you care. And when I was a kid, I was like 9 when he started the private side of the business. I didn't believe in most of these things that I just said. I thought it was a lot of baloney.
Yeah.
No, really. Because look, you think that those things sound like empty words. And when I became a doctor, I was like, yeah, this is a business like every other, you know. It really isn't. Once you start treating these people, you start caring. And once you start caring, you start knowing their names, their kids' names, their pets. Yes. They become friends. You start caring. And I just saw a guy who I did a fix of his cornea a few years ago, and I was so happy to see him again. He's so happy. He sees better. It's like you really start caring. And I think that's the biggest thing that surprised me about being a doctor is how much you actually care about someone who's just a patient.
Right. A prior podcast guest we had here, Johnny Gayton. He had a great saying that I learned from him when I was very young. I had no gray hair at the time. I had more hair. And Johnny Gayton said, he says, patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
And you know,
like,
what?
Wow, that's deep.
That is like, look, and one of the things that I try to teach residents when they work with me is I say, what's the name of the guy coming through the door? And if they don't remember, I'm like angry with them. What's the name of their kid? How many kids do they have? And they're like, why is that important?
Yeah.
Because if you remember the kids, if you remember the siblings or parents or whatever is important to the patient during surgery or during the exam, the patient will know you cared enough to remember who they are and what's important to them.
Right.
Because if you remember those two things in their mind, you care about them. So they can't judge me as a doctor, but they can judge me as a person. And if they see I care, they will know that I will not do to them something that I would not do to myself. And that's the second rule of our clinic. Do not do a single procedure on your patient which you would not be willing to do upon to yourself, your child, or your parent. Now, the parent part is a little bit dangerous, but all jokes aside.
Yeah, of course.
You will not see people in our clinic selling refractive surgery, but not having refractive surgery.
Right. You had your laser vision correction done like
I had two. I had, so I was born with hypoplasia of my optic nerve in my left eye. So I have no stereo vision, which I always tell my visiting doctors, if I can do lenticles with one eye, you can do it with two. But the thing is, I was born with a bad optic nerve on my left eye. And my best corrected vision is maybe 20/20/80, something like that, in that range in my left eye. But I had a lot of astigmatism on this eye. So naturally, when I was 21, I said to my dad, hey, listen, let's do a LASIK on that eye. Who cares? Like, what's going to happen to it? I'm not going to use it.
Right.
So I had microkeratin LASIK with a Moira M2 and a wave light laser in my left eye when I was 22. And honest to God, I saw maybe a few thousand LASIKs by that point. For me, that was a 1 second procedure. The keratin was like zick, zick, lift. Zzz. It was so quick.
Yeah.
I still remember it. But I was a latent hyperope in my only eye. And was it now? About 2 months ago, I told my colleague, hey, listen, I can't read in the evening anymore. And I don't want to start wearing glasses all day because that's not going to be good for my business.
Sure.
So you're going to laser me. So my manifest was plus one with plus one. But my wet refraction was plus two plus one. So naturally, I entered plus 250 into the laser. I overcorrected myself to about 0.05 because I only have one eye and I'm 35. And I would rather be half a diopter of myopia in my 40s than plano in my 50s.
Yes, because for sure.
My life is within 4 meters.
Right. Right.
So,
right,
yeah, I did have LASIK. My father had LASIK just before he bought the wave light for our clinic. And then most of my colleagues here, my wife had it. And then when time came for my dad, because he's a diabetic, he got cataract surgery for early diabetic retinopathy. No, not diabetic retinopathy, early diabetic cataract.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Right for him. So he chose a symphony for his first eye. It was in 2017. And he said, you know what? I'm post-LASIK. I have a EDOF IOL, and I'm happy. And then when COVID hit, he was really bored. You know, there's no surgeries. There's nothing happening. What do you guys think if we put a trifocal in my other eye, the one with a clear lens? Okay. So we put a synergy in that eye because that was his non-dominant eye, again, post-LASIK. And he's now 20/20 distance. And when he does... let's say strabismus surgery or some little stitches, doesn't use any readers or any glasses whatsoever. And if you ask him, would he do it again? He's like, yeah. And it's a great tool when a patient comes to us and says, hey, do you guys recommend this type of surgery? We say, yes, but is it safe? We say, look, if it's good enough for us and our father who owns this, I think it's good enough for you.
No, that's true. It is like a family in your clinic. One thing I loved was in your exam room on the wall, you had 1,000 little Polaroid pictures of all the patients and some details about their surgery and how happy they were. It really, like, I loved that idea. I have to copy that.
I started that when I switched from mainly doing LASIK, which everyone knows in this part of the world, to lenticular surgery. And I had, first of all, it's a transition that is going to happen. Right now, I think it's going to happen for everyone at some point. But for me, when I started, it was very difficult for me to tell my patients, hey, get this other type of surgery for more money. And they would say, why?
Right.
So I don't know anyone who had lenticules, but I know many people who had LASIK. So I started taking Polaroid shots of people who I've done lenticles on. So I would put them on the wall and say, maybe you don't know these guys, but they had lenticular surgery. You can see the date and you can see their vision. So it was a way of expanding the amount of people who understand that it's something that's being done. Because look, if you go out on the street, LASIK is such a common name that all laser vision correction for patients is LASIK.
Everyone knows it.
But lenticule is a different concept. And because they don't know anyone who's had it, there's always this little bit of a
hesitation.
Exactly. And by seeing 50, at first I was, you know, I was not stupid. I first took maybe 30, 40 shots and held them in my drawer. And then I put them up at the same time. Because if there was only one, it would not really look well. You know, I used to do marketing before I was a doctor. So.
And now it's the whole wall. It's the entire wall.
Yes, now it is the whole wall. I have filled the last two slots maybe 20 minutes ago. And now the wall behind me, the beautiful galaxy, is going to go away next week. And we're going to put the second wall. But this time I'm going to be smart. I'm going to take the big ones. Let me show you. It's a great trick. So this is the old style photo.
It's a regular. It's a regular size Polaroid.
Yeah, but look at this. This is the mini size. Smaller one. Yes.
You can put more of them.
I will have at least 2 years on that wall.
Oh, that's very good. I also enjoyed. I learned something else from your clinic too, which was, first, wow, what beautiful results with that Schwind Atos laser. I'm so jealous we don't have that in the USA. I think it's the only laser you're using now for lenticular. You're not using any other laser.
We used to use two other lasers, but now that's the only machine I use. But look, for me, Atos is like I feel like I'm a grandfather to the machine. In a way.
You're very involved with the engineering department at Schwind.
Yes. So when Schwind came out with the laser, they had one in Nepal with Dr. Kishore. And that guy is like he's a hero for both Zeiss and Schwind, because he was one of the first Zeiss users and then one of the first Schwind users. Not one, he was the first user. But as COVID started, Schwind couldn't travel with their people to Nepal to keep supporting the development. So they needed someone in Europe who was close. And Zagreb-Frankfurt has 4 flights a day. So he said, hey, Ivan, can you and your clinic help us? So Assistant Professor Bohac and me, we said, sure, let's do it. So we were the first European users and the second on the planet to use the machine. And it was not the same machine as it is today. Look, 4.5 years of active development really does wonders. But I have to be honest, we changed way more than the machine did, because when you switch from PRK to microkeratome LASIK, okay, it's a concept. But when you switch from microkeratome LASIK to femto LASIK, that's a whole nother animal. But then when you switch from femto LASIK to lenticules, there's a new learning curve. It's not only about doing the case. It's how you manage pre-op, post-op, how do you program the machine, what's the target. And the biggest issue is surgeons keep thinking about their personal experience of the surgery. They keep trying to recreate something they know.
Mm.
You will probably remember that when ECC was being replaced by FACO, everyone was saying, why would I do this thing with these things? It's just so much easier to just push the lens out. Why would we do this?
Right.
It's a different concept. If you think between ECC and FACO, there's a lot less involvement in the surgeons when they're doing ECC. You just make a hole, push the lens out.
Right.
Now, that's a skill that's lost today, but 30 years ago, it was everyone knew how to do that.
Right. So, well, surgical techniques keep evolving.
That's the trick. But tell me one thing. When you do great cataract surgery, do you care about the post-op result next day or the amount of hand movements or pedal movements you have to do?
No, you care about the results, the patient's visual outcome.
The problem is LASIK was so simple. You just do flip, laser, back, flip, and there's no real surgical involvement. And right, the surgeons had amazing results. So why would they have to switch to something which is way more involved and at points really difficult?
Right.
If the results are not there. And this is, I think, what was the biggest problem for lenticule adoption, is this: surgeons keep trying to match the experience they're having with the results that their patients need, which it's, I always tell them, stop optimizing for surgical comfort and optimize for day one results. And honestly, I have to be very honest with you. When we started with this, I said to the guys in the company that in my head, nothing will ever replace wavefront guided femto LASIK, because that is the gold standard. That is the best there is, and there is nothing that can compare to it. I was that guy. Today,
but now
you can't pay me to do a LASIK if I can do a lenticule. Right. And the best part is, I'm not even sure the guys in the company had this amount of trust in the platform, because there's a guy in the company called Thomas Wendler. He was the R&D boss on the project, and he's been in Schwind for 20 years. And 4 months ago, he flew from Germany to Zagreb to bring a special SD card with the software to do the first ever pure cylindrical lenticule on any machine in history. Wow. So he brings the card, puts the card, we install the software. He's like, okay, that's it. And tomorrow we do the first case. We do the case. The patient is 2018 the next day. He goes to me and says, Ivan, I worked with eye lasers for 20 years. I think I am now ready to have my own surgery.
Nice.
And he had surgery on the same day as I had. So I did his case. He was a minus 1.5 sill in both eyes. He's 42. He was 2012 the next day.
Wow.
Amazing. And as I finished his case, we just switched spots and I went on the under the laser to get my LASIK for hyperopia. So it was so all anyone, done in anyone one day.
Anyone who's pure cylinder or myopic ablation, only lenticule, and yes. Then you just save the LASIK for the hyperopes.
Yes, and the mixed astigmatism for now.
Okay.
But to be honest with you, I didn't believe that this will ever happen for me. So I got a challenge from the company. They said, hey, Ivan, look, you keep saying that lenticules are an alert. They're, in your mind, an alternative to LASIK. And I said, yes. But there are people in Korea, and they mentioned my friend today, David Kang.
Right.
Who's a great guy. And, you know, for him, LASIK is an alternative to SMILE. I'm like, no way. And they're like, look, here's the results that he's getting from his Visimax. Why do you think that he can do it? Do you think he's a better surgeon? Maybe you're not as good. Like, what do you mean? Well, you know, he programs his laser into this very low dose regime and it really makes wonders for the visual acuity. Like, but you probably can't do it. You're not a good enough guy to do so. I'll show you.
Challenge accepted.
Exactly. Until I was challenged as a surgeon to say, okay, maybe you are doing something wrong, because if there is one single person on the planet achieving a better result than you with the same idea and the same technology, maybe the problem is not the technology, maybe the problem is you. And this was a very humbling moment for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I had to accept that the machine is still the same as it was 4 years ago with minor software changes, but in general, it's still the same way of working. But I changed how I do it, and I accepted that someone else is doing it better. And this was the key moment for my personal growth story in lenticular surgery. And since then, today I did a case of 0.50 sphere in a guy who is 20/20 uncorrected distance.
That must be a really thin lenticule.
It was 28 microns thick.
Wow.
In the center, and in the periphery, it's zero on the eye.
Zero. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the optical zone for that was 8.0, because you want to make it as big as possible so that you have more thickness, because we don't have the minimal add thickness on Atos. And I'm quite certain, and I asked the patient, why are you here? And this is, let's say, the third rule of our clinic. The first rule would be the patient is the king or God. You don't do to them what you would not do to yourself. And the third rule would be understand why they are here. Right. So if you walk from my door and you're, let's say, 37 and you're a minus one, I will ask you, why now? Because it's, you know, it's been a long time since you had this. Why?
Right. About 10 years ago.
Yeah. So what is the thing that's driving you to come today for me? If I see someone who's 18 or 19, I only have one question. Military or police academy? They have to have very good vision. They don't get accepted here unless they are 20/20.
Okay.
So usually they're like, how do you know? Because I see that you're barely 18. So I understand why you're here. But when you're 20/20 uncorrected with minus 50 of sphere, I asked the guy, why are you doing this? Why do you want me to do a case on you? Like, look, it's perfectly safe, but there's still some risk. So he goes and says, I ride my mountain bikes downhill. And you know what? The difference for me is if I see a tree at 100 feet away or 500 feet away, very right. Clear. And I can plan out more into the future so I don't crash.
Right.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Because I think that in America, you always start with patients with, what is your chief complaint you would like to address today?
Right, right, right.
I start every consultation, okay, what is it that you want to do in your life that you're being hindered by your vision?
That makes sense. That really makes a lot of sense to understand.
And when they get scared during surgery, if I remember, okay, he wants to go scuba diving, I say, okay, listen, you want to go scuba diving? Get your act together for the next 3 minutes. Because you remind them why they're under the machine.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That, what was their motivation for seeking vision correction?
Because look, think about it. I had a lady, she's Plano plus two ad power, and she doesn't want to wear reading glasses. I said, okay, well, what's your motivation? Yeah. Do you do crochet? No, I just watch TV. Yeah, you're not going to be happy, lady, because you can watch TV without this. Yeah, but I sometimes want to read. Yeah, but you're going to lose something in the distance. And right. This is what I love about your videos is when you try to explain, and this is a thing that most doctors never get to understand. They don't understand what MTF means. They don't understand what contrast loss means. And they don't understand that once you put any optic that splits the light up,
right,
you will have some loss of visual quality.
There's a compromise.
The patient is not understanding that.
Right.
So you have to be very certain that this person will achieve more and they will go from bad to great or bad to good. If they go from good to good, if they change one problem with another, they will not be happy.
That is so true. I mean, our plastic surgery colleagues are easy because they can show you before and after pictures and you can understand, okay, what happened. But for us, patients have to have better vision after surgery than they did before, not just a trade-off, but an overall improvement that they're going to meet or, you know, exceed their expectations. That's for sure.
And I think this is a very, very difficult conversation, especially because, look, if most doctors would prefer that the company comes in and says, okay, here's a lens, and this one is going to be great for everyone.
Yeah, I wish.
Don't ask the patient, don't think, don't use your brain, just put it into everyone and you're going to be happy.
Right.
There is not a product on this planet
right.
which would fit that criteria.
That's true. Yeah, you've got to tailor to the patient. Of course.
And even my beloved lenticules, they're not a cure for all. There right. are still some cases where another type of surgery or even no surgery would be a better suited option.
Yeah, for sure.
The problem is you as the surgeon are the sole person responsible for continuing with the patient's decision to do it or not.
Right. No.
How do you do it? Like how, okay, I know you told me that you reduced the amount of patients you see and that you use pricing to achieve a very good blend of what you do. But how do you make that final decision? Because
I know what's the limitation of surgery. What's the limitation of the technology? I understand that if you're a 50-year-old Plano emmetropic presbyope who says, I want to get rid of my glasses, I know if I do bilateral, trifocal, multifocal lenses, you're just not going to be happy. Because I know you're going to give up better quality night vision. And in my mind, I understand, okay, the lens is splitting up the incoming light. The photons are distributed over a wider range. So the quality is a little bit less than the MTF. But I can't explain that to the patient. But I do what you do. I treat from the heart. I say, listen, if you were my brother, I would tell you this is probably not the best solution for you. And at this point, the better answer is not to do surgery. And he said, why not? I want surgery. I said, well, because the results of surgery and the technology is not going to meet your expectations, and you got to be straight with that. And I think basically what we're saying is you treat patients from the heart and from the brain. Don't treat them from the wallet.
Right? So yeah, but you've been in clinical medicine for how many years?
Oh my gosh, I finished med school in 1996.
I started elementary school in 1996.
Thank you. I feel a lot better. Thank you.
Thank you. But that's the trick. When you start out, when you're young, you don't have that instinct about patients. Yeah. And you usually don't have this level of knowledge and understanding because not a lot of residency programs are going to teach you anything about premium IOL selection or refractive surgery.
Right.
There are some,
yeah,
but those are very, very, very few. And especially the problem is going to be, even if you go for a program like that, unless you keep up with the IOLs and the lasers and everything that's coming out, you're still going to be behind the curve of the products that are available versus what you understand about them. So there is a little thing that I, you know, my father is one of those guys who says to us, take the patient into the room, look at the patient on the slit lamp, then decide what needs to be done, and then talk to the patient. He's an old school guy. I don't talk to my patients unless I have all my scans done and I've seen their eye
in
an objective way. And I've made the decision before they walk through the door what's good or not for them.
Right.
So one of the things that when I go through all the papers I read about IOLs and the lasers and everything is the way we report results, we always talk about quantity of vision. Oh, this patient is 20/20, or this patient is 83 letters of ETDRS, or we're just counting how much they see, which tells you very little about what is the quality of vision.
Right, for sure.
And this is, I think, one of the biggest hurdles in our business because you said to me when you saw the patients after lenticles that we've done here in Zagreb, how happy you would be to have that same level of results.
Yeah, for sure.
But on paper, your results are the same as mine. They're 20/20 or better.
Yeah.
Not all 20/20 is created equal. And this is something I learned with IOLs. Because IOLs, you can have an IOL which is J1 plus and 20/20 distance with a super unhappy patient, because their quality of vision is low.
Yeah, for sure.
So this is, and when we started with lenticles with the Visimax 500 over 10, 15 years ago, I think it was 2012, so 12 years ago, we had a problem. The patient was 20/20, but he was complaining. So we couldn't understand why. He was complaining that the image was soft.
Right.
It doesn't look clear,
but it was
20/20.
Yeah.
So today we've actually co-developed with CSO a parameter which is called microaberration scatter index, which measures the little refractions and diffractions inside the lamella, so you can quantify how good the vision is. So otherwise you would have to go and do a sine wave contrast test, which is a 20-minute hassle for you and the patient. High volume centers cannot afford that.
Right.
So the thing is, in LASIK, we were delivering great quantity and quality of vision.
Right.
And with a monofocal lens, you deliver great quality and quantity of vision. But a full range IOL, which is the new official, I think, name, the naming schemes are going to kill us all. they deliver a lot of vision when you look at a quantity, but very low quality.
In comparison, for sure. Well, because the number of photons that's entering the eye is the same.
Yeah. You have I tell my patients, look, I have 100 units of light. Okay. And you tell me where you want 50 to be sent. To the near point or the distant point? To the near point. Okay, now you have only 50. Spread them for center and for distance. Oh, how can... No.
Right.
Once they have to make the choice, they start to say, but I need them here and here. Well, then there is no product which will deliver 100 in every point. And this is... I always tell them that there are two extremes for presbyopia correction, and that's the pilot and the dentist.
Oh, okay, makes sense.
Both of them need perfect vision. But one of them works at, 1 feet? And the other works at, 20 miles.
Yeah.
But the dentist needs to see the calendar on the other side of the room, and the pilot still needs to see the instruments in the cockpit.
Right.
But what's important is not inside for the pilot as much as is outside. And he doesn't need to be able to read a label in pitch dark on a chopstick.
Yeah.
As well as, but they're the extreme. So I ask my patients, if this is the range, this is the dentist, this is the pilot, where are you in this range? So they have to choose.
I love that. I have to steal that. That's amazing, actually.
So if they are the dentist, then they get a trifocal or a hybrid EDOF, whatever they call them these days, or an Odyssey, which is pretty good. Very nice lens. But if they are a pilot, no. It doesn't work for you. You're going to get something different. Maybe in your case, a Vivity, or in our case, now we have access to PureSee, which is a great IOL. And there are some new products from Hoya and from Sifi, which are really, really, really interesting, because these lenses are now shaping wavefronts and playing around with lens shapes, which are non-diffractive and yet deliver a lot of vision. So I think we're looking at a big revolution.
Yeah.
But that revolution is still going to require the doctor to make the final choice.
Right.
But that requires the doctor to have some chair time. I kind of remember I was told that every minute of chair time before surgery decreases the risk of a lawsuit later on by tenfold.
Well, it does make a lot of sense. But even with these new technologies, if you're outside in the moonlight, the number of photons entering your eye is fixed. You can't make the moon any brighter. And that's what you get. You can divide it up, as you say, divide it up however you want. The dentist to the pilot. You tell me how you want to split the incoming light.
I think that we have to. So one of the things that I also like doing is, especially with this objective diagnostics that I always do, I involve the patient in the decision process. I have a huge 30-inch screen in my office, and I open their scans, and we look at the scans together and I say, look, if I do this, we get this. If I do this, we get that. What do you think? Because they feel that they are coming to you for your expertise. But today's patients, they know something. They're not as, like 20 years ago, you know, think about it. If you were to do the LASIK you were doing in the 90s or the early 2000s to someone today, you'd probably get sued. Small optical zones, thick flaps, minus 10s, you know, those were crazy times. And yet those people were super happy.
Yes.
So you cannot say that was bad surgery, but you would certainly not repeat it today.
Well, because we evolve. It's the same way if you come in with a typical cataract, I'm not going to do an extra cap.
And the other thing is, I think that people like you are really helping in that, is when we stop talking about cataract surgery as just cataract surgery. It's not cataract surgery now. It is refractive surgery every single time. Because even if someone is a brunescent or intumescent cataract, you still expect them to be plano. You don't want them to be a plus five. It would be you would be very upset.
Right.
The standard of care has gone up so high, while the effort of us as surgeons to achieve it has gone down. Because look, when was the last time you took out your A scan? Do you even have one?
This week, I still get sent to me totally white cataracts or black cataracts with zero view. And okay. So I still got to do an A scan. But you're right, it's unusual. Let's say it's 1% of the cases.
Okay, exactly. I think we've used the A scan maybe twice this month, but it's not something you would do regularly.
No, correct.
When was the last time you did a manual K reading with a Javal or a Bausch & Lomb keratometer?
I don't think we even have one anymore.
That's the point. We have so many great tools today which help us immensely to give better outcomes, and yet the pressure to provide keeps increasing. Because look, 10 years ago, a patient who ends up with a minus one sill and maybe a little bit of decentered IOL would not be an issue. Today, you're actively thinking about lasering them to make them super plano, even after regular cataract surgery.
Right, for sure.
Because right now, one of the things that defines, and I think maybe at some point it would be kind of cool if you spent a few cataract coach lessons on it, is There is an index of the development of a society called cataract surgery rate. It is an official index from the, I think, United Nations or the OECD, Organization for Development. And it's called CSR, right. Cataract Surgery Rate. So it defines the number of cataract surgeries per 1 million people in a country. So for a country like the United States, you guys do about 9,000 cases per million. But a country like India does maybe 17 or 1,900.
So much less. Yeah, yeah.
So the thing is, highly developed nations, I know the stats for Europe because that's where I am, like the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, the UK, they're all above 9,000 cases per million. But okay. The southern countries, like, let's say, Greece or Albania, Bosnia, even Croatia, we are below 5,000 cases.
Mm.
So you think there's less cataract in our nation?
No,
it is the indication for surgery. You see, in a rich country, most of the patients who come to you have a maybe subcapsular or a very early stage plus one nucleus cataract, but they're 20, 25, maybe 20, 30 at worst, and they're getting surgery. In India or a less developed African nation, you're getting cataract surgery when there's no light perception.
Right.
So that's the difference in the number.
Yeah.
This is what causes, because in an affluent, rich society, you don't want your old people to have cataracts. You do that. But the problem is, once you do it to a person who's 20/20 or 20/25 or 20/30 before surgery, that's because that's when the expectation is high.
Yes.
So it's the expectation didn't rise because we have better technologies, because we're now treating younger and younger people with less and less severe cataracts.
Right.
Even today, in my country, people say, oh, you need to wait for the cataract to become mature to do the surgery.
Yeah.
No, that was like 30 years ago, but it's inside people's heads.
Yeah.
You have to wait for it to mature. So if you look at cataract surgery as an indicator of wealth and stability, it is an amazing index. It shows you so much about a country. It shows you how much it cares about its elderly population.
Right.
And it shows you what's the expectation next day.
Right.
But there's another cool factor.
Which is
it
what?
Has been linked to lower levels of dementia and lower levels of injury. Because if you have an old lady with cataracts and she doesn't see where she's walking, she's already got osteoporosis because she's 80, and she falls down and breaks her hip, wouldn't it be cheaper if you did her cataract when she was 72?
Right. For sure. Oh, for sure, for sure.
So cataract surgery is the most important single surgery, and I can attest to it, on the face of this world.
Oh, I certainly love it.
No, honest to God, there is not a single medical procedure except vaccination which has helped more in such an easy way.
Yeah.
And we have commoditized it. And I saw the video from the robotic surgery.
Yeah.
That is the next step. And
it's
that's going to make the CSR go up even higher.
Yeah, no, it's all coming. Yeah, you were mentioning in the old days when... in the 1990s and before, doctors would tell patients, ophthalmologists would tell patients, you have to wait until the cataract is ripe, as if it's a fruit.
It's an ECC, so you needed it to be, you know.
Right, so the idea was that their pre-op vision should be so terrible that even if you did that ECCE and caused all this irregular astigmatism and you had vitreous through the wound or an ACIOL, it would still be an improvement for the patient.
Exactly, because we were the ones lowering standards.
Right. For sure. We're doing great now. It's a different world. So you're right. We do surgery earlier. Patients have higher expectations. It's a lot tougher.
But I think that, you know, it's funny. I don't consider myself a young guy anymore because I'm 35, but apparently young ophthalmology is until 40 in Europe. So I'm still...
I know. It's at least, believe me.
I'm young. I think that the generation that's coming today is going to have a very different world. I think that we are losing a lot of skills. For example, minimally invasive cataract surgery, or what you used to call ECC. Right. We have lost that skill. There's whole generations of surgeons who don't know how to do it.
I'm still teaching on cataract surgery.
That's why I'm saying you're doing a public service. That's why we gave you an award, my friend. You are doing a public service. But there is hope. Because of the complete liberalization of the way we educate ourselves,
right?
If we have the inclination to learn, there is no limit to learning.
Yes, for sure. That's so, how I learned DMEC by watching videos online.
Look, and I know you had Lucio Burato, and that's how we actually got in touch on your show. And when he was doing video cataracta refractiva, he was recording physical tapes and then going to his office, recording the tapes to another tape. You know, you had a copy of a copy of a copy of a tape of some interesting case Lucio did.
Yeah.
That was learning in the 80s and 90s.
Yes. Yes.
You had to know people who had access to those video cassettes. I don't even have a video cassette player. I don't know that they even make them anymore.
I don't have one either. No one has one.
I don't even have a CD player.
Yeah, no one does.
So the idea is, with the internet being so free and so open, we have so much opportunity, but it leads to a problem. It's called, how do I choose from where and what to learn? Because everything and everyone can look legitimate.
Yes.
How do you choose your mentor? So for you, you went to a great school and you had access to great surgeons. But you did not have to validate and vet those surgeons yourself. They were vetted by the institution that you were a part of.
Right.
So in today's world, you have speakers, professional speakers who sound amazing. You would trust them with your children and your savings. And yet, you can't really vet in a way as you could before.
Well, that's why I've got to see videos of them operating. Or even better, like I came in person and watched you do a dozen cases live and in person.
Yes, that is the way. And this is whenever someone asks me about, when I get on stage and I speak about the lenticules and the cases and the results, I oftentimes get people saying, that's a lie, that's impossible. I tell every single person who doesn't believe me, you know what, come to my OR. Any day of any week, but you have to stay for 2 days. You have to stay for the surgeries. You have to see them next day. Yeah. Because unless you see them next day, you will not believe it.
And I did that. I saw the surgeries.
I know.
I saw the post-ops with you.
And you know what? If that doesn't convince you, nothing will. But this is the thing. How do I share this with thousands of other people? This is why guys like you, you're an influencer, a KOL, a teacher, and someone who is promoting excellence in eye care, right? And you have a platform. By having you talk to people like me and others, you're vetting us for these other people. And you know what? If 10 people contact me and say, hey, Ivan, I want to come and see those lenticules you talked about with Udai.
You're like, come on over.
Make my day. Yeah. It's going to make my day, because you know what? When they say, oh, that's a kid from Croatia, why should I trust him?
Yeah, no, for sure.
So this vetting process and this, it's become so convoluted. So young people can't really choose their mentors as easily as they could before. You knew where you wanted to go. Today, I don't know who I want to learn from, because I don't know who I can trust. Of course, I know 20 people by heart.
Yeah, of course.
There is probably, 150,000 ophthalmologists on the planet.
Lots and lots of ophthalmologists.
And I know you told me you were visiting every single country you can and going to do the speeches. Do you see this in these young people, this drive to become better?
Yes, for sure. The new generation of ophthalmologists is going to be amazing, because they have an ability that I could never do, which is they can compress the learning curve. By these videos, like cataract coach, the idea is 5 minutes a day. I promise over the course of a year, you'll become so much better. Why do you need to suffer from a complication. Let me show you the complication in high def on your phone. You can watch it anywhere on the planet. Let me show you how do you recognize it. Here's the cardinal sign. Here's how you prevent it. If it does happen, here's how you recover from it. Let me teach you everything. And I even have a new series on Cata Coach. I'm teaching all the secrets. I will democratize surgical education. My secrets, like the reason one was, how do you do IOL calculations in ultra-high myopes? Let me tell you all the secrets. How do you do lens calculations in the post-RKIs? Let me teach you. So I'm giving away every secret.
No, oh. And you know what? One of the biggest secrets doctors kind of hoard is, how do you do it in post-LASIK eyes? It is such an easy thing to do. We do, because my father started doing myopic ablations and hyperopic ablations 25 years ago. Many of these people, because look, if you have laser vision correction in your 30s, by the time you reach your 60s, you're way more inclined to go get rid of presbyopia or an early cataract, because that's in your mindset. I don't want glasses. So these people come back, and we have done so many calculations. And every time I go to a event and Congress, people talk about all these miscalculated lenses. I just don't understand. How does that happen to them?
Yeah, well, even on that, we're going to get a new world. You know, in the U.S., our group here with John Lattice, Advanced Euclidean Solutions, we got a U.S. patent in February of this year for our AI-based methodologies for doing calculations, IOL calculations. So this is all going to be automated. The honing your ACONs is going to be antiquated. You're never going to do that again. It's all going to be done behind the scenes in the cloud automatically. You'll have to do nothing. Yeah, it's going to be better and better.
But you know what? I actually wanted to work on an AI project to create this algorithm of deciding what procedure for what patient, where the machine would ask you, okay, so what does this person do? What's important? And then, you know, the dentist, and but I never have the time to do it. But I think that would probably be useful, especially to younger surgeons just starting up, so they are more inclined to try new things. Because when, you know, there's always a lot of pushback whenever a new IOL comes to the market, because they remember, oh, that rep, he brought that IOL, which created that problem with that lady.
Yeah,
she's been bugging me for... You associate the company and the person bringing the IOL with a negative outcome, which might have happened with any IOL.
Right.
So you're more unwilling to try new things, especially as you grow older and in your career, you become very conservative. And then you start saying, you know what, I'll just do the bare minimum to make sure that it's good enough. And I think good enough is the biggest enemy of greatness.
This is, I have a friend who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, a heart surgeon, one of these guys who basically works incredible, crazy long hours. He says they have a saying in their field. The young heart surgeons, cardiac surgeons, are so aggressive. They're such cowboys. They'll kill you. And the old cardiac surgeons are so passive and so conservative, they'll just watch you die. Yeah. So he says, you need someone who's kind of in the middle, not too much of a cowboy and not too passive. You need to have someone with a good amount of experience who's going to help you, like, you know, do actually what's best for you.
You know, we're a teaching hospital here. So we have our own internal residency program, and we get people from med school. And with every generation, and this is, I think, now generation 8 or 9 of kids going through our program here, you try something new. So right now, I am going to attempt to first teach this generation on how to actually sit and act as a doctor, and then teach them medicine. Because these kids, they talk to someone who's twice or triple their age at some point.
Right.
And they're so tight, so strung, that they start losing their words. They are unable to communicate clearly.
Right.
So now we are starting from the basics. So, okay, you're going to sit and you're going to be relaxed because you are in a position of power. You are the doctor in this room. And these soft skills, I think they're very important because they promote confidence. And if the patient is confident, they are going to be a happier patient.
No, for sure, for sure. I think that's important. You know, even little things. I'll tell you a funny story. When I visited your clinic and saw the post-ops, I thought that I knew how to check post-op acuity. Okay, read the chart. And so in your clinic, the patient reads the 20, 30 letters, and then they're like, that's it. He's like, that's it. And you're like, no, read the, what's the next one? And they read 20, 25 letters. And he said, that's it. I said, no, you said, read the next one. And they read all the 20, 20 letters. And then you said, the patient said, oh, no, I'm done. That's all. I can't see anything. And you said, come on, try. What's the next one? And the patient's actually 20, 15. It was amazing to me. The patient, whatever reason, was very hesitant to kind of just read the letters, the small letters.
It's an interesting thing because, and the best part is that they go and, you know, on your chart, every chart has five letters and there's probably 10 different letters in each position. So sure. It's like, you know, a good number of possible combinations. And they're like, you know, I read that line, but I guessed all the letters. I'm like, what do you mean you guessed the letters? Because, man, there's five different letters with 10 right. possible letters in each right. position, and you read every single one correctly. You know, the chances of you guessing that is very low. So you've read them. But I don't know if you remember the little credit card trick. Because 2015, what does that mean to your patient? That doesn't mean a lot. Or even
oh, this is a good Europe, one. Oh, please tell our audience. This
in
is
Europe, we use the decimal system. So I say to them, okay, you're 160% of vision. They're like, what do you mean? How can you see more than 100%? And it's like, it's always the same conversation. But I tell them, okay, you've now read, you know, that line. Yes. Okay. And I take out this little Jaeger chart that I have in my office. And here it has a little ruler. And on this ruler, there's millimeters. We use it to do PD, you know, quick and dirty. I say, go to the chart and measure the height of the letter line that you just read. And they go out and say, okay, it's 4 millimeters. I say, okay, now take out your credit card from your wallet. They take out the credit card. I say, now measure the height of the letters on your credit card. They're like, what do you mean? I say, just indulge me, please. So they take the credit card that they put here. Like, oh, it's 4 millimeters. I say, okay, so let's go back for the facts. You've read the line with letters which are 4 millimeters high, which is the same as on a credit card from 4.5 meters away, 16 hours after surgery. Yes. Okay. I mean, that's really impressive for me. I don't know if it's impressive for you. And then they start laughing because they're going to tell that story to their friends. They're going to be, you know what? I could read the letters which are the size of the credit card numbers.
From 4 meters away. Yeah.
Because that's a story. Go. You can imagine someone going out for drinks and saying, look, I can read that credit card from 4 meters away. I say, prove it. And then they do it.
Yeah.
But if they're sitting there saying, you know, I had surgery. I say, oh, cool. And I see 2015. Oh, okay, cool.
Anyway,
I got a new car.
Yeah.
It's not a – you have to make it fun.
Yeah.
Word of mouth is a billion times – more important than any social media marketing you can ever do.
Right.
Because social media and advertising can only do so little, because every doctor on the planet can record the same video with the same facts, with the same letters, with the same graphics. But your patients and their experience with you, that's something that's a personal thing. That's you. That's your touch. And it cannot be emulated. The way I do it, the way you do it, the way my dad does it, my brother, or anyone else, it's their individual style, and that's what keeps them high. But that requires you to be open. That requires you to want this. That requires you to be passionate about your work. And that's the difference between a great doctor and an okay guy.
Yeah, I think you're right. The passion is the key. And that really comes across. And because if you love something that much, it's not worth doing it. You enjoy it. And you're motivated to be better and better and learn more and more. And it benefits ultimately you, but of course, most of all, the patient.
Yeah. And look, I'll be honest with you. I, in the past 5-6 years, have spoken to many, many, many great guys face to face. And 99% of them are very chill, very cool guys you want to go have a beer with.
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe that success comes down to their personality, not just their surgical skills, because there are certainly high-level surgeons, but not with that level of social skill, who are not able to attract the patients.
Yeah, you need to have both. It's not that easy. You gotta have both,
especially in private healthcare.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Well, what a fun conversation. It was so much fun talking to you last hour. An hour has gone by like this. I can't believe it.
It was really an honor to do this with you.
My pleasure.
A great guy and a great teacher.
So you heard it here directly from Ivan. If you want to go visit Zagreb, Croatia, and see some beautiful surgery and post-ops, I promise you'll love it. I did it in October, and it was a lot of fun, and I was really impressed. The only sadness is I don't have those lasers here in the USA.
You know what? I have an idea. Do you remember when LASIK was still not FDA approved?
Right.
Well, there was my dear friend Maria Clara Alberaez was doing LASIK and PRK in Aruba. So Americans would fly out to Aruba to do surgery there and spend a week in a nice hot place.
You see, now always a possibility, I suppose. But now neat stuff.
Maybe we should make a little artificial island off the coast of California.
We'll put that on our to-do list.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Thank you very much for having me. And that offer really is true. If you want to see the way lenticles should be done, and if you want to see them better than 2020 next day, you're free to visit anytime you want.
Well, I'm going to have links below for Ivan's clinic, and you can check it out and contact him through the website. And again, thank you so much. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new podcast every single week. Top podcast all of ophthalmology for a reason. And of course, every single day, there's another Cataract Coach video. 2,400 videos and counting. Stay tuned. So until next time, I'll catch you later.